of Elman University in Champaign, locally owned and operated and serving families since 1925. Owen's Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Well, I'm sorry to say that it looks like we're not going to be able to have our conversation this morning with Malcolm Gladwell. We're planning on talking with him about his new book, Blink, which looks at rapid decision-making and how it is that some people seem to be quite good at it, and he argues that we could all be better at it. He is now out on book tour, and I expect probably we'll be able to find another day to have this conversation. So stay tuned. We'll let you know. Instead, we are reaching into the Focus 580 archives for a recent conversation we had dealing with the rebuilding of Iraq with a guest, Noah Feldman, who has written a book on the subject. And we thought as the elections are coming up here this weekend, this would probably be a good program to repeat. So hopefully you have not heard it the first time around. In any case, do keep in mind as you listen that we will not take calls in this hour of the show. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking about what is arguably the biggest challenge facing the United States today, and that is working toward a secure and free Iraq. And our guest for the program, someone who has had some personal experience in this effort, his name is Noah Feldman. He is currently Associate Professor of Law at the New York University School of Law, where he is co-director of the Center on Law and Security. He's also a member of the coordinating committee of the Yale Middle East Legal Studies Seminar and is an authority on constitutional law, as well as being one of today's leading experts on Islam and democracy. He was named Senior Constitutional Advisor to the Coalition authorities in Iraq in April of 2003, and then after that became advisor to the Iraqi Governing Council, charged with creating the interim constitution for the country. He is the author of the book, What We Owe Iraq, War and the Ethics of Nation Building, in which he argues that this particular situation, the rebuilding of Iraq, poses more ethical dilemmas than any previous nation-building effort. Professor Feldman, hello.
Yes.
Thanks for talking with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
In the book, you begin with a story. You talk about the fact that this was in 2003. You were on the way to Iraq. And at that point, you were busily trying to bone up on Iraq. And we're reading a book about Iraq and the Shia of Iraq. And the story you tell in the book is that you were sitting there, you were poring through this book and just trying hard to think about Iraq. You looked around at what the other people on the plane with you, who were all going also to Iraq, were looking at. You said they weren't reading about Iraq. What they were reading about were books about the American occupation and reconstruction of Germany and Japan after World War II. And in the book here, you make the very strong point that Iraq is not Germany and Japan after World War II. This is something completely different, and that it would be a mistake to take that as our model. What makes Iraq so different from the other nation-building efforts that we have been involved in?
The greatest difference between the different circumstances, the post-war reconstruction that we did in Germany and Japan on the one hand and our experience in Iraq on the other, is that Germany and Japan were fully developed industrial states that we had fought a world war against and defeated, but in which the governmental structure had not completely disappeared. By contrast, when we hit the ground in Iraq, the entire government collapsed like a house of cards. And the looting that followed the fall of that government sort of brought home to ordinary Iraqis that there was no government in charge at all. As a result of that, we weren't able to impose a new government on the ground there, and that is a major reason for much of the troubles that we've seen since then. So the key point that I wanted to emphasize in telling that story is not that there aren't useful things we can learn by analogy. There are. It's just that if you're going to engage in an occupation reconstruction project, you have to understand the local conditions on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Well, what that also would suggest is that some of the people who were involved in this effort, at least at that point, were not thinking about the situation as it was. I mean, they were going into it perhaps with a set of assumptions, with a mindset that was not appropriate to the situation. Does that still apply?
Well, first of all, David, I think you're completely right. The mindset was one of wishful thinking or an imaginary Iraq in which a burgeoning middle class would step up and create secularist democracy without us having to do anything except for eliminate the bad guys. And that was not in any way really corresponding to reality. It was really an Iraq that was a figment of the hopeful imagination. I think some of the people who felt this way initially have since then realized that the realities on the ground are very, very different. Some of them are no longer working in government and have been replaced by slightly more realistic people. But some of the spirit, some of the wishful thinking spirit of that early period, I think, did continue through most of the period of occupation. And frankly, I think some of it still remains in the policies that our government has been pursuing there. Take the question of elections, which are supposed to happen in just over 3 weeks. Every single day we hear of bombings and other kinds of intimidation taking place in Iraq. And it's going to be extraordinarily difficult to have an election that's even slightly credible. And yet what we hear again and again from the administration is, oh, don't worry, the elections will come off just fine. And that also owes something to this idea that if we will it, then it will come true, which is not always the best way to go about policy in the Middle East.
Mm. Well, just to stay with the subject of the election for the moment, it's scheduled for 30th of January, so we have now less than a month. And as you say, the administration very consistently has been holding to the deadline. They don't want to talk about postponement. And I think that you and other people have argued that better to have the better to do it right than do it and have it be flawed or have it be questioned or have it be something that everyone doesn't participate in, and so to get a result that essentially doesn't mean anything or it doesn't mean what it should. What do you think about the administration's continuing to hold to this idea that, no, here we set this date, we're going to have the election, that's that, and as you say, it'll be okay?
Look, it's good that we should stand tough against people who want to intimidate us out of holding elections. We shouldn't allow ourselves to be pushed around by the insurgents. On the other hand, there comes a point where reality has to set in. You have to admit that it looks likely that participation in this election will be pretty low in Sunni areas, maybe close to zero. And then in other areas, if the security situation doesn't improve, the numbers could start to come down as well. If I thought there were some chance of bringing the Sunnis to the table and encourage them to participate in elections if we increase the security situation, then I would be for delaying the elections. It's a little unclear whether we can do that, however. If we had a lot more troops, we probably could, but we don't have a lot more troops. We don't really have the extra troops available at the moment. We might be able to muster up another 30 or 40,000 troops, but it's not even clear that that would ultimately make the difference that we need to make at this stage. So it's a very hard policy question.
Yeah. I don't know if at this point it's productive to enumerate the failures again. Some people, I think, are tired of hearing about it, and other people might just say, well, we need to move on. Mm-hmm. Despite the fact that we made mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, I think some people hearing that would say, well, we've got to bear in mind that the mistakes that we made set the conditions that we're operating under now, so that it's probably a good thing to think about where it is we went wrong and how it is that that's put us in the place that we are today. I mean, if I asked you this question, what were the most important things that we did wrong, what would they be?
Not enough troops. And I think you're exactly right that we should focus on what went wrong only insofar as it's productive and useful for us to do things right going forward. We did not have enough people on the ground to convey to the Iraqis the thought that somebody was in charge. And into that vacuum walked the insurgency. We can try to repair that now by giving a firmer sense to Iraqis that we actually are in charge. But of course, it's harder and harder to do that as the bombs are blowing up all around. The bombs have the effect of communicating even more that we're not fully in charge. But I really think that the key to the what's gone wrong so far in Iraq has been that we haven't had a strong enough troop presence. We had enough troops to bring down the regime, not enough troops to control the country afterwards. And to the extent that we can remedy that, we need to remind ourselves that that's part of the problem and that's part of the solution.
Hmm. Why were we so wrong about what would happen once the government of Saddam Hussein was gone?
We weren't all so wrong. General Shinseki did say publicly that it would take, I think this is a quote, several thousand U.S. troops to successfully control with the situation in the country after Saddam had fallen. But I think what happened is that we got caught up in an internal debate within our military establishment about how many troops it took to win the first part of the war, the bringing down the other regime, the old regime. Many in the military, the senior officers, thought that we needed lots of troops. They were exponents of the so-called Powell Doctrine, the idea that you need to always go with overwhelming force. On the other hand, Secretary Rumsfeld believed, and it turns out he was right, that you could bring down a regime like Saddam's with a relatively light military footprint. So the whole fight turned out to be about how we could bring down Saddam, and nobody paid the kind of attention that should have been paid to the question of what would happen immediately afterwards.
Mm. But it also seemed that there was this assumption, there was this belief that there was this intact civil society in waiting, and that all we had to do was get rid of the repressive Ba'athist regime, get rid of those people, and that these other folks would, you know, they would cheer, they would say hooray, they'd say, we got rid of that guy, and they would step up to the plate, and the next day things would start operating in an ordinary and orderly way, which turned out again not to be correct. But what was wrong with that assumption? I mean, was it truly that there was not this civil society in waiting, just ready to step up? Or were those people in fact there? Or were there other sorts of mistakes or misjudgments made that short-circuited that possibility that life, that normal life would pretty much start as soon as the fighting stopped?
The idea that there was this civil society in waiting, I think, really came from thinking about Eastern Europe, places like Poland, where when the Soviet Union finally backed away and the old government crumbled, organizations like the Solidarity Group that Lech Walesa was so central in sort of stepped in to take the reins of power and avoid violence. The problem was that although those communist regimes were repressive, Saddam's regime was even more repressive. Saddam was, if you would put it this, might accept my putting it this way, he was an even more successful dictator in the sense of totally repressing every attempt by ordinary people to form their own organizations outside of his power reach. So, for example, there was an organization in Iraq, still is, called the Iraqi Lawyers Association, which had 25,000 lawyers. It sounds like our American Bar Association or some other civil society organization where ordinary people get together outside the government and, you know, form associations and write reports and have meetings and so forth. But in fact, this organization was completely dominated by a senior lawyer who was named by the president, by Saddam, or by his son, Uday. And that organization wasn't actually a civil society organization. It was the shell of a civil society organization that had been gutted out by the autocratic government. And the reason Saddam was able to do that is because he had the constant flow of oil to use for money. He didn't owe anything to the ordinary people in his society. They didn't have to pay taxes. They didn't have to have allegiance to the regime. It was enough if they were afraid of him, and he had the money to keep them afraid. And I think where that's the governmental structure, it's very difficult for civil society to emerge if, in fact, you have a dictator who's willing to kill anybody who stands up and takes a position.
Let me introduce again our guest, and then we have a couple of callers we'll get to. We're talking this morning with Noah Feldman. He is Associate Professor of Law at New York University School of Law, where he is co-director of the Center on Law and Security. He is an authority on constitutional law, one of today's leading experts on Islam and democracy. He has authored a number of books, including one that we're talking about here this morning. It's titled What We Owe Iraq, War and the Ethics of Nation Building. The book is published by the Princeton University Press. And again, as I mentioned in the beginning, he makes the argument in this book that this great challenge that we face is perhaps more difficult, certainly poses more ethical dilemmas than any previous nation-building effort. The book is out in the bookstores, of course, if you'd like to read it. And questions and comments here are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. To the phones here, we have a caller in Bethany on our toll-free line, our line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm enjoying your talk. Hey, correct me if I'm wrong. It seems to me at the end of the first Gulf War, the coalition did not go into Baghdad for two reasons that I remember. First, the United Nations stipulation was to just get Iraq out of Kuwait. And second, I remember hearing talk that the Arab states that were supporting us didn't want us to go into Baghdad and take down Saddam because they were afraid of the chaos that would ensue. What with the Shiites, the Sunnis, and the Kurds, their theory was that it takes a strong man to hold that country together. Am I right about that?
I think you are, sir. I think everything you've said just about till then is completely on track. I think that's correct. And what's more, the first President Bush 41, as you might call him for short, the 41st President of the United States, the father of the current president, he understood that there were major dangers associated with trying to occupy a country like this, specifically the danger that the country might fall apart. And he even said so in some interviews that he gave after he was out of office.
Well, that's what I remember, too, yet we completely disregard what the people in that region had been saying for years, that they wanted to keep Saddam just to keep order.
Well, that's true. On the other hand, before we get too convinced that we ought to be listening to what the folks in that region wanted, we should keep two things in mind.
Mm-hmm.
The first is that a lot of the regimes in the region are themselves violators of human rights.
Oh, that's true.
So and they didn't want anybody being thrown out of power and a democracy replaced because it might give their own people ideas.
Yeah, true.
You know, another is that the U.S., in the course of pursuing this policy of keeping Saddam in power, we were complicit in some pretty terrible stuff. You know, we, for one thing, encouraged the Kurds and the Shia to rise up right before we decided not to go in to Iraq, and a lot of them, probably several hundred thousand Shia and perhaps 100,000 Kurds, were then killed by Saddam as we more or less stood aside and let them do it. So our hands aren't all that clean either, unfortunately.
Well, thank you. That's just a couple points I'd like to have wanted to talk about.
Great points.
Thanks for the call. We'll
Bye.
Go to someone else here. The next caller is in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Yes, thank you. I think that we have not learned the lessons of our own revolution, that it's almost impossible for a foreign power to beat a determined insurgency. We're never going to have enough soldiers to put on the ground at this point to, you know, stop an insurgency. And I don't think the American people are going to, you know, even if we could somehow muster 1 million soldiers to put over there, I don't think it could possibly happen. And I personally think that, you know, it was a mistake to invade in the first place, but be that as it may, that the current administration has been totally incompetent in carrying out the operations that they've set forward. And I think it's time for us to admit that we've lost the country, we've botched it, and maybe, you know, we could call on the UN to help in some way to try to bring about a transition. But I don't see any possibility that, you know, we can occupy that country continuously. And if we do allow any kind of real election to happen, probably the first thing on their agenda is going to be to try to remove the United States from their country. And I don't think that the Bush administration wants to give up the bases they've established there. And I don't think they're interested in democracy either. I mean, after all, you look at the 100 points that Paul Brenner put in place before he left. That was designed to make sure that the economy of Iraq stayed under the control of the United States. I'd just like your response to that.
Well, sir, you make a variety of really interesting points, and I think I agree with some and perhaps disagree with a couple of others. I think you're right to say that it's extremely difficult to sustain an occupation of the kind that we're describing when there is broad-based, concerted opposition to it. The question is, are we at that point in Iraq yet, or are we not? Remember that the Shia community in Iraq is not engaged in an insurgency against us, and that's about 60% of the population. The Kurds are not engaged in an insurgency against us. That's another 20%. That gets you up to 80% of the population right there. Among the Sunnis, which is the last 20%, except for a handful of Christians, I think that the vast majority are very unsympathetic to us and do very much want us out, but most are not active participants in their insurgency to this date. So the point of our presence there should not be to sustain an occupation for the long run. It should be to enable the majority in the country to sit down with this disaffected Sunni minority and negotiate for themselves a constitutional government that can actually work in our absence. Now, I think that elections, as I said a little earlier in the program, are very risky right now. But if they do, in fact, come off, which is not impossible, you will see a government that's dominated by Shia interests, many of them Islamists, who will say that they don't like us, that they want us to leave as soon as possible, but who will understand that right now we're the only military force in the country capable of sustaining it. They will revoke any of the laws put in place by Ambassador Bremer and the coalition that they don't like, and they're empowered to do so as a matter of Iraqi law and as a matter of international law. And I think that you will. I expect to see them reversing some of these laws that were passed, some of which may have gone too far in terms of trying to set up an economic system that it was, in a well-intentioned way, thought might work for Iraqis, but which, as you say, opens the door for example, foreign direct investment, which I think a lot of Iraqis are not that crazy about. And I think we may see some reversal of some of those norms. So I think that the prospect for the longer term here is that the U.S. will actually be very eager to leave because the public will not be interested in sustaining the kinds of casualties that we've been sustaining. The Iraqis will be very eager for us to leave, but they will know that we can't go until we've provided a kind of security environment in which they can set up a government that can actually govern on their own.
Well, and I think you also would make the argument to Americans, to this caller and to others, that we can't go until we do that either.
That's exactly right. And here I would bring in the ethical side of the picture. It's not enough just to say, well, we made a mistake. We invaded. We've created a disastrous situation. Too bad. Time to leave and hand it off to the United Nations or some other entity that doesn't have troops that's prepared to devote on the ground. At that point, we're like a driver who engages in a hit and run and then flees the scene instead of coming back and taking responsibility for what's gone wrong. And we can't afford to do that. We can't afford to do that in terms of our international reputation. And more importantly, we can't afford to do that in terms of our own moral standing as Americans. That's not the kind of country we want to be, and it's not the kind of country we should be.
Well, let me ask you for a moment to talk about one of the basic points that you make in the book about what nation building is supposed to be about. And specifically here in this case, what, because you certainly have made the case that it is important for the United States to work along with the people of Iraq toward a secure and free and democratic Iraq. If we ask this question, okay, at the most basic level, what is in it for them? What is in it for us? And is it actually possible for these interests their interests and our interests, to be satisfied?
That's a very good way of putting the question. I think what's in it for them is, first of all, not to live under conditions of chaos, but to have some kind of a government that actually is capable of governing. A government that can govern in Iraq will not be another dictatorship. That dictatorship is gone, and nobody can easily replace it, even if they wanted to. A government that's going to govern successfully needs to represent a range of different opinions and values in Iraqi society. Now, a government that represents those interests will not always do what we want it to do. For example, it's likely to be rather seriously committed to Islamic values, much more so than many Americans would be comfortable with, since we are very proud of our own separation of church and state, and we're nervous about Islamic governments. On the other hand, we also need there to be a stable government in Iraq. We also cannot afford a situation in which Iraq is chaotic, because it will harm our interests in the region by promoting instability. In the long run, it will lead to much higher oil prices, which are very much not in our national interest right now or ever. And indeed, it will potentially lead to tremendous suffering for ordinary Iraqis, which will be our fault because we will have started the ball rolling in that direction. So I think in this case, there is enough overlap between our interests in having a secure government that can actually govern and the Iraqis' interests in having a government that's legitimate that we could work our way to something that satisfies both sides.
Just, I realize this is taking a little bit of a side street here, but as I said, and as you are someone who has done a lot of thinking about Islam and democracy, can you talk for a little moment about that and address the concerns that some people might have that somehow those two things, that Islam and democracy, are incompatible, and the idea of having a true Islamic democracy is somehow something that just can't, by definition, somehow can't exist?
I'd be glad to, and I don't think it's a sidebar at all, because, frankly, the kind of government that we're going to see in Iraq once we have elections of any kind is a government that corresponds to what Iraqis want. And they say very clearly that their vision of democracy includes a significant role for Islamic religion and for Islamic institutions. What's happened in the last decade in the Muslim world is that many, many people who are deeply committed to their religious faith and who believe that secularism, as tried in their part of the world, was unsuccessful. It was unsuccessful economically, it was unsuccessful culturally, it was unsuccessful militarily, have increasingly come to argue, I'm talking about Muslims here, that Islam and democracy can work together. And what they have in mind is elections, which are compatible with Islam, although they're not required by Islam. They have in mind the rule of law, which is a traditionally Islamic idea, not that one king rules by his own whim, but that the law comes first and the king comes has to act pursuant to it in classical Islam, and in the modern world it would be an elected president or prime minister acting pursuant to law, and that they believe that these principles can coexist with, let's say, family law being governed by Islam, by the society looking to Islamic values when it tries to decide hard moral questions. And this model, they argue, will actually do better for their countries, because instead of feeling like democracy is imposed from the outside as some Western import, this will feel like it's a distinctively Islamic version of democracy. Now, there are some problems with this. For example, what is the status of non-Muslims in the society? Are they equal citizens? And the more liberal Muslims say, yes, they will be equal citizens, and others are a little more concerned about that. What about the role of women? Again, the more liberal Muslims who are pushing this view say Islam is perfectly compatible with the equality of women, and women will vote, as indeed they're going to vote in Iraq, as indeed women vote in every majority Muslim country that has elections. Saudi Arabia, women don't vote, but nobody votes in Saudi Arabia. So I'm giving you a bit of a long answer because it's an important question. But basically, throughout the Muslim world, there are factions that say, we want Islam and we want democracy and we want them both, despite the tensions. We think we can work through the tensions. And they're trying to win over the hearts and minds of Muslims. And in my view, we in the United States ought to be on their side because they're the best alternative to the radicals whom we know we don't want to see in power. There isn't a large secular movement in the Muslim world saying we want separation of religion and government. That just doesn't exist at the moment. So I think we ought to go with the best option that we've got, and that option right now is Islamic democracy.
We're just a bit past the midpoint here. I have several callers. In fact, the lines are full, and I'll get right back to them in just a moment, but I do want to reintroduce the guest. Noah Feldman is an authority on constitutional law. He has written on the subject of Islam and democracy in his book, After Jihad. He was a senior constitutional advisor to the coalition authorities in Iraq in 2003. He also was advisor to the Iraqi Governing Council charged with creating the interim constitution for the country. He is associate professor of law at New York University School of Law and also author of a new book that explores some of the ideas that we're talking about here this morning. And this book is titled What We Owe Iraq, War and the Ethics of Nation Building. It's published by the Princeton University Press. On to the callers. And first in line, Chicago, line number four. Hello.
Hi. I'm a little bit disturbed by some of the explanations you've been given. For example, I'm explaining one of our mistakes and the major mistake of realizing that there was no structure to replace what we destroyed. You said it was because Saddam Hussein was oppressive. That's outside of the point. The point was that Iraq was a one-party state, and any political scientist would have been able to tell the administration, and perhaps they did, as General Shinneki told them about the troop size, and they were ignored. But they would have been able to tell the administration that when you have a one-party state, all administrative, all the organizational structure in the society is based on that one part, on that one party. And when we came in and said that anyone who was a Ba'athist could not be involved in the government, we automatically shot ourselves in the foot and slit our throats at the same time. So, you know, to go into personalities really doesn't help. And that alarms me because you've got this stay the course attitude, and it's a course that's really wrong because we keep going into particularities, which we seem to think are very important, and ignore generalities, which is all the information we have because we really don't understand the particular aspects of Iraq. We don't understand their history. We don't speak their form of Arabic. So why are we trying to deal with particularities when we need to look at what we do know, and that's some general knowledge?
Well, I think, ma'am, generalities are very valuable, no question about it, but they can also be misleading. So, for example, many in the administration said Saddam's Iraq is a one-party state. So was Poland before the collapse of the Soviet Union, and look how wonderfully Poland did. So was Latvia. So were many of the Soviet satellites. And in those countries, very often, once that party collapsed, others were able to step in and take the reins of government. And that's one reason, for example, that in April of 2003...
I think that's not true, because in Poland you had the Solidarity Movement, which effectively created another structure.
Oh, I entirely agree with what you're saying, ma'am, but that's
which
a perfect example... That's a perfect example of where the particularities of the differences between Poland and Iraq were tremendously important. And yet, I think we did not pay sufficient attention to those particularities. There was too much reliance on the abstraction of the, well, one-party states can sometimes transition to democracy. In fact, you need to know what's going on in the particular country in order to apply the general knowledge that you were speaking of. So I don't think that you and I actually disagree so much about this. I think we both see eye to eye that it's important to be aware that in a one state, where there's a one-party state, there may be no real civil society institutions that have the capacity to succeed. And you have to know that that's the case. You can't just assume that there's going to be civil society institutions there.
No, we don't agree, because I think that you are being very slippery in your explanations. And I also see that as you continue to say that, well, we can't leave, we have to have ethics. What is the ethics of our group punishment and bombing populations just so that we can protect the few soldiers that we have, even though they are civilians? Combining ethics and what's happening now in Iraq is an oxymoron. That's not that there's no ethics involved. And I don't see why we should stay a course that is causing an enormous amount of cruelty to the Iraqi people, mainly through our actions, and they are more and more blaming us for it. I think to me the ethics would be to remove our soldiers from harm's way and prevent and stop them from harming the people of Iraq, because they are becoming sitting ducks. Our soldiers are basically there trying to protect themselves. So you envision that we have 10 bases throughout Iraq, which are like military citadels, and they're not going to be the focus of insurgent groups in Iraq? No, I don't think that's going to happen. That's not the type of future. And I don't think the American people are going to continue on for the next 10 years, which seems to be the conservative estimate now, taking these fatalities.
Well, here I think there is room for genuine disagreement about what the right ethical thing to do really is, because my concern is that I share with you the desire to do the ethically correct thing. And if I thought that our presence was only going to do more harm, that it was only going to be an oppressive presence that was harmful to the Iraqis, then I would share your view that we should leave. My concern, though, is that it's very convenient for us to say, now that things are going poorly in Iraq, now that there's real cost to the United States, that, oh, it's in the Iraqis' interest that we leave, so let's leave and bring our troops home, and then allow the country to collapse into a civil war, which will essentially be of our own making. By contrast, to the extent that 80% of the population still wants there to be a successful democratic state, but cannot possibly accomplish that goal without our help, I think that the ethical duty that we now have, regardless of whether we should have gone on in the first place or not, is to enable that newly, the government that's going to be elected, again, not perfectly, but that I hope will be elected, to have a shot at producing its own form of government. Because if we just allow it to fail, which is exactly what it would mean right now for us to withdraw, the consequence will be that Iraq will certainly, guaranteed, be thrown into the chaos of civil war that could last for many, many years. So I don't want us to maintain troops in Iraq just to do it. Very far from it. I only want us to maintain troops if the Iraqis believe that it's necessary to sustain peace and security. And I think in the long run, the Iraqis would like to see our troops replaced by international troops. And if the security situation could be brought under control, then I think international troops would be prepared to go. It's just that insofar as right now the situation on the ground is extremely dangerous, you can't get any troops from abroad to any countries from abroad to devote their troops to the region. So I think your view is very, very plausible. I think reasonable people can disagree about this. But I would just urge you to remember that our withdrawal will facilitate, in fact, it will guarantee the collapse of the country. And I don't think that that's the ethically correct thing to do at this stage.
I'm going to jump in. I hope the caller will forgive me. We only have about 15 minutes, a little bit more left. I have a number of other callers and I'd like to get on to some others. We'll do that. To going next to someone listening in Bloomington, Illinois. That's line number 3. Hello. Is there a caller in Bloomington?
I think I'm on 3, but I'm not in...
Oh, pardon me, in southwestern Illinois. This is line 3. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I have a couple of comments if the time's available. One is, I think one of the things that we may not have thought going in was the impunity with which neighboring states and Middle Eastern states would be able to send in troops and supply a terror. Somebody said that you don't have an insurgency unless you have another government to put in its place, that this is just sort of a general uprising without any other government trying to take over. But anyway, that aside, it seems to me that the problem is the neighboring states that are sending in supplies for the terrorists and for and troops and I don't think and I'd like your opinion on this. I don't think that the main worry about in the other states is worrying about democracy. I think what they're concerned about is, I mean, think what would happen if this works. You get an Iraq with a stable government. What would happen in that case? Investment would stream in from probably all over the world, including many of the rich Arab states. And the first thing you know, the Iraq would be the central nation in the Middle East. I mean, it would be the cultural, the industrial, the commercial, and possibly even the religious center of that whole region. And I think that that is one of the things that the reason the other countries are so willing to see that it doesn't succeed, but because they don't want to be, I mean, they don't want Iraq to become greater than they are, and Iran, of course, wants to be the central state. What's your opinion on that?
Well, I think that I agree with almost all of that, sir. I think that the other governments in the region are very nervous about the potential influence of Iraq. Those that are non-democratic are worried about it becoming a democracy that succeeds and then sends a message to their people. The Iranians are worried that the center of power in the Shia world is in the process of shifting to Iraq and that Iraq is going to be a freer and more democratic society than theirs is, and that therefore the influence will actually go to the very heart of their own politics or the hardliners in that country. And I think that they're right to be worried about that. I think that does have a chance of still happening.
Don't you think that to some extent they are concerned about the fact that Iraq would really probably enjoy a boom that would place it, you know, in the ascendancy among in that region?
I do think that this has been a worry from the beginning of the Iranians and from other governments in the region. On the other hand, as the insurgency has gone as badly for the United States as it has, some of those countries are now just worried that Iraq will fall into the kind of chaos that will actually spill over into their borders. Their initial sense of sort of repressed pleasure that things weren't going as smoothly for the United States in Iraq as the United States had hoped has, I think, given way to some real concern that the situation there might get so bad that, in fact, it could spill over into something like regional civil war. Because in the end, the name of the game for these other governments is stability. They want stability at all costs.
How would this this election and its validity compare? Of course, there was a civil war, actual civil war then, but how would this compare with the election held in the United States during our civil war? I mean, the fact that...
That's not a bad analogy, because what we may see is that in the Sunni areas, nobody shows up to vote, because the Sunnis are either too frightened to vote because they're worried about the attacks that potentially could take place on polling places, or alternatively, they're boycotting. What worries me about that is that you could then have a constitutional negotiation taking place without the participation of a significant percentage of the population. Now, after our Civil War, during the Reconstruction period, when the Republican Congress wanted to pass the 14th, 15th Amendments, the amendments that guaranteed equality for African Americans and the amendments that abolished slavery and so forth, they actually essentially told the southern states that unless they ratified those amendments, they wouldn't be allowed to come into the Union again. Now, I think that was the right thing to do at the time, because I believe very deeply that those amendments were necessary to make our Constitution a fair and a just one. But they were very troubling for the subsequent history of the country, because although the southern states ratified those amendments, by the implementation of Jim Crow in the years after Reconstruction was over, they contrived to avoid applying those amendments. And I'm worried the same thing could happen in Iraq, that if you negotiate the Constitution without the participation of Sunnis, they will ignore the constitution once it comes into place and perpetuate a civil war rather than peace in the long run for the country.
Well, one difficulty is that the Sunnis are right in the middle. Instead of being on one end or the other, they're in the middle of...
That's very true. The geography plays a big role in this entire story, and a central Sunni region, it's one reason we can't split the country up, because the central Sunni region, unless it's shared in the oil resources of either the south or the northern part of the country, would have no viable source of income itself, and it would be landlocked. So that's one reason that it's crucially important to hold the country together as a kind of federal entity.
Yeah. Well, I could say more, but others are waiting, so thank you.
Right, thank you, sir.
Thanks for the call. Again, I want to quickly reintroduce our guest for anyone who might have tuned in the last 5 or 10 minutes. We're talking with Noah Feldman. He is Associate Professor of Law at the New York University School of Law, has written a book about Islam and democracy titled After Jihad, and also more recently, What We Owe Iraq, War and the Ethics of Nation Building, published by the Princeton University Press. We have a couple of Urbana callers here. We'll go on next to line number 2. Hello.
Am I line number 2?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. I remember reading that Dick Cheney in 1991 explained all the reasons why we shouldn't march on Baghdad. All the different religious groups and ethnic groups fighting among each other, various Iraqi leaders deciding that they would oppose the United States and head an insurgency, and so on, not enough troops, and this problem and that problem, supply, and so forth. And then all of a sudden, in 2002, he changes his tune. It's easy. It's going to be a piece of cake. We'll have people throwing flowers at us. Everything is going to turn into a democracy, and everything will be just fine. So what happened there? I mean, is this some deep, devious game? Did he actually change his mind? Did he go crazy? Or because his first analysis, one might say, well, what a wise man, because everything he predicted is true. But then what? I don't understand.
Well, I think you're asking a rich and very, very interesting question, ma'am. So, and it's hard to get inside of any one person's head, but let me take a crack at it, okay?
Okay.
I think there was one major world-changing event that took place between the decision of the first Bush administration, Bush 41, not to go into Baghdad at the end of the first Gulf War, and the decision more recently of Bush 43 to do so, and that difference is 9/11. Let me just play the argument out if I could. I think the difference is that the attacks of 9/11 led many within the administration to believe that in the long run, a Band-Aid approach, which is essentially what we used in the first Gulf War, Saddam went into Kuwait and we kicked him out and put a Band-Aid over it, that the Band-Aid approach in the long run was not going to be successful, that what we needed to do was to fundamentally transform the politics of the region, and that the way to do that was to start with one bad actor in Saddam and to show that a democracy could be constructed there. Now, this may have been a fundamentally mistaken view. I think the jury is still out on that, but I do think that it explains the change in perspective.
I mean, go on, Professor Feldman. I'll give the caller a chance to redirect, but I just want to make sure that you have the chance to make your argument.
I'm just suggesting. You know, the question was about what changed, and I think what changed was the view that it wasn't enough just to tell bad actors that they should reform their ways. We had to actually change things in a fundamental way. That was a very ambitious approach, very risky approach. And I think the jury is still out on whether it's going to be successful, or and in which case they will look like world historical figures, or whether it's going to be disastrous and a failure, in which case they will look like world historical failures.
Okay. Well, the caller want to ask a follow-up?
Well, yes. How can you do that with so little troops? And how can you negate the fact that all these religious sects and ethnic groups are still at each other's throats? I mean, if I'm shouting, I'm sorry, but it strikes me as being so stupid.
Well, it's always easier to say that things are stupid once they've started to go terribly wrong. Look, I agree with you that it was never plausible to do this without a lot of troops. I really agree with that. With respect to the diversity in the country, though, I think if we'd had the larger number of troops, if we had been able to communicate to Iraqis that we were really in charge, I actually think we were on a reasonably good track of avoiding the breakout of the kind of inter-ethnic insurgency or potentially civil war that we're seeing now. But look, you know, it's 20/20 hindsight for all of us.
Okay.
All right. Well, let's go to one more caller, at least in the time that remains. This is also Urbana. It's line one. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I think there's one important point that's completely overlooked. The perception, not only in Iraq, but throughout the Middle East, that we have no intention of setting up a democracy, that we're setting up a puppet state. And as long as we stay, that will be the dominant issue, and there is no hope of any accomplishment. The neocons did much too much loose talking and writing. If you read Friedman, if you read Wolfowitz, you know they were talking about a 100 or a 50-year beneficial empire. And the Middle Easterners are not fools. They know this. And we saw what they did to the British in the 20s.
Well, I think that you're entirely right that if the government that comes to pass in Iraq is perceived as being an American puppet, then it will get no credit whatsoever for respecting human rights, if it indeed does, or for being democratic, if it indeed is. On the other hand, a remarkable thing is about to happen in these elections, again, provided they come off at all, and that is that the parties that are going to be elected, that are going to dominate the electoral outcome, are going to be Islamist political parties. The lead man on the ticket of the largest party spent the last decade in Iran, and he is the head of an organization called the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq. These are not natural U.S. allies. These are not people who are going to look to the rest of the world when they appear on television with their robes and their turbans as though they were classic American dupes. We usually like our dupes to wear suits and ties, and at one time, or military uniforms. So I think that the truth is that there's, albeit unintentionally on the U.S. side, a chance that the new government in Iraq will not be seen as simply a puppet of the United States. And then the test will be, can this government succeed on its own? That will not be an easy thing for it to do because they themselves aren't crazy about the United States, but they probably need our troops in the short run to get control of the country. So it's going to be a very delicate negotiation for them. Hmm. My view is that we should let them follow the policies that they wish to follow, because it's not good for them or for us if the new government is seen, exactly as you suggest, sir, as our puppet.
I've got to jump in here again because we're almost out of time. We have a couple of minutes left. But I'm interested in this perception that that some of the callers articulate and that I'm sure that people in other countries have, that it looks like what we're doing in Iraq looks like imperialism. What do we do to address that perception? And maybe it's not something that we can address in the short run, but it's something that must be addressed. And again, that's something that you look at in the book as we are engaged in this whole business of nation building, how it is that we get ourselves out of the older kind of mindset that comes from the period of colonialism and empire building.
Well, David, I'm really glad that you raised that point because it is a very important one for me in What We Owe Iraq in the book. The point that I'm trying to press there is that even though nation building is freighted with the legacy of our past efforts of colonialism, indeed the past efforts of other countries like the United Kingdom in colonialism, nonetheless, we need to try to get it right and to cleanse this nation building practice of the assumptions that made colonialism so troubling. And the most important of those assumptions was the assumption that we know better how to get things done, that we in the West, with our rich democracies, know how other people should order their lives and know how they should build their governments. I think we should abandon that idea. I think we have to accept the reality that we have no better idea than anybody else how exactly to build a democratic government. What we do have right now is the capacity to provide security. And that's all we should be doing. When it comes to designing a constitution, when it comes to setting up institutions of government, that's got to be the Iraqis' decision. It's got to be for the Iraqis to do those things on their own. They want to do them on their own, and we should stand aside and let them. And then, over the next 50 years, not today or tomorrow, but over the next 50 years, we'll be able to say, and others will be able to say, that instead of just pursuing our own imperial interests in the region, we actually facilitated Iraqis making decisions for themselves. That would be a best-case scenario.
Well, we've talked about the election several times, and they are scheduled for the end of the month, but we have, I think you have, and more than once, used the word if they occur. What's your level of confidence that they will? Because some of the reporting that I've seen recently out of Iraq suggests that things are certainly not getting any better, and that in fact, as people are paying more attention to the disaster in Asia, that with our being distracted, that in fact things have gotten a lot better, a lot worse in Iraq, that causes some people to raise questions about whether the election can take place at all.
I think that's a very reasonable concern. Look, the U.S. administration has been saying again and again, as has the Iraqi government, that the elections will go forward. But to say the elections will go forward and to actually hold them are two very different things. And as we get closer to the last deadline, if it looks as though polling places have not been set up, or as though the security of those polling places cannot be assured, and that ordinary people throughout the country will be afraid to show up and vote, then I really think we could potentially see a delay, or we could see a situation where an election is held in the sense that the polls exist and some people show up to them and some of those votes are counted, but in which so many people don't participate, either out of fear or because they're boycotting, as to make the results of the election not meaningful ones. So you could have an election that takes place but doesn't really take place in that sense, if you see what I mean. Those remain live possibilities at this stage. And if it looks like that's what's going to happen, I think we should just say discretion is the better part of valor. And at that point, we should actually openly admit that we need to delay and regroup.
Well, there, we'll have to leave it for now. Our guest, Noah Feldman, is Associate Professor of Law at New York University. In 2003, he was Senior Constitutional Advisor to the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq. He's the author of the book After Jihad, America and the Struggle for Islamic Democracy. That came out in 2003. And recently, What We Owe Iraq, War and the Ethics of Nation Building. That's published by the Princeton University Press. Professor Feldman, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, sir. It's a great pleasure to have been with you.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 archives. We originally broadcast this interview on January 4th. Many past Focus interviews, also conversations from the Afternoon Magazine, all of our local production is available on our website, and you may listen anytime you like. It's at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Our program, Focus 580, made possible in part with support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. Focus also made possible by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. And we will try to reschedule that interview that we were going to do in this first hour of Focus 580, talking with Malcolm Gladwell about his book, Blink, The Power of Thinking Without Thinking. We will get back to our usual live schedule here, hour number two, as we talk with Virginia DeJohn Anderson. She is an historian at University of Colorado. We will talk about her book, Creatures of Empire, How Domestic Animals Transformed Early America. We'll also have news at 1 minute past the hour, but first, an update on the commodity market, so please stay tuned.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey at the Chicago